the magic button, so we have begun. Okay, we're back in the book of Daniel. I'm conscious that it's about a month since we were last looking at the book of Daniel. We've had the Day of Atonement, of course, and the Feast of Tabernacles, and then a weekend, perhaps, many of us getting back to our normal homes and so on. So I think before we move any further in Daniel, we'll take a bit of a review of what we've done so far. And in particular, I guess I'd like to go over chapters 7 and 8 a little bit more, because we did somewhat hurry through them last time, and they're so packed with information that it's difficult to get all of it out. So just as a reminder, back in Daniel chapter 1, we were introduced to Daniel, who was taken into captivity as a very young man. And even in his earliest period in captivity, he demonstrated a certain amount of courage and wisdom, and was soon noticed and elevated. And Daniel turned out, of course, to be a man of exceptional qualities. He was mentioned as being of a similar quality in terms of his righteousness to the likes of Noah and Job. And that was a reference made by Ezekiel. And Ezekiel and Jeremiah and Daniel lived pretty much at the same time. So Daniel, quite an outstanding individual from his teenage years. And he ministered for many, many decades through a number of changes of king and government, and probably lived into his late 90s. Potentially he went beyond 100. We don't know quite how he ended, but an outstanding personality. And the book of Daniel, a very important book. Mr. Herbert Armstrong, I believe, always said that to understand the book of Revelation, you would need to have a good grasp of the book of Daniel. And of course, the book of Revelation is not one we've tackled so far, and it's a bit of a daunting prospect. There's rather a lot in the book of Revelation, so I might put that off for a wee while. But certainly, the book of Daniel is a good groundwork for us in understanding the end times. And if we turn to Matthew 24 just for a moment, we can see that unlike many commentators who believe Daniel is a made-up figure, and the reason they say that is because Daniel's prophecies are so accurate from way back when, right down through the centuries, that they think, well, you know, this is impossible. Nobody could be that accurate, and of course they're dismissing any divine inspiration. So they assume that the book of Daniel was written by maybe some Jewish writers much later on, but no, it was written by Daniel the prophet, and we know he's a real person because Jesus says so in Matthew 24, which is the end time Olivet prophecy. If we pick up the story in verse 14, Matthew 24:14, Jesus in red letters in my Bible says, "And this gospel of the kingdom," and that's the gospel that, you know, Jesus preached and Paul preached and that Mr. Armstrong preached, the gospel of the coming kingdom of God, "will be preached in all the world as a witness to all the nations, and then the end will come. Therefore," says Jesus, "when you see the abomination of desolation," whatever that might be, "spoken of by Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place, whoever reads, let him understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains," and bad times are about to ensue. That's why they're told to get out of there. But you see that Jesus refers to Daniel as the prophet, and even refers to part of Daniel's prophecy. And Jesus says, "Look, people, when you see with your eyeballs the abomination of desolation standing in the holy place, as described by Daniel the prophet, get out of Judea." And so it's quite evident that you know, Jesus saw Daniel as a prophet, and his words as worth our while looking at. If we go back to Daniel now, and let's move on to chapter 2, because chapter 2 is a very important chapter in the book of Daniel. Nebuchadnezzar, a great leader and a man that God worked with and through, Nebuchadnezzar had this incredible dream of a great statue. And you remember that he could not remember, or was not prepared to admit to what he dreamed, and he wanted the wise men, the astrologers and so on, to tell him both the dream and what the dream meant. And this was a dream that was given, a vision almost, by Almighty God to this emperor, to King Nebuchadnezzar. And it's quite, I guess, interesting that God would work so dramatically through a Gentile king. And there's no question that Nebuchadnezzar was an outstanding man himself. But he had this strange dream, and nobody could explain it, so he said, okay, in that case, off with their heads. All these wise guys, smart alecks, I want them all slain. And of course, Daniel came to the rescue because he went to God, received the wisdom. And to pick up the story in Daniel 2:36, we can see Daniel explaining this key prophecy, and is one that applies today. There is an application of this prophecy to our days today. And this prophecy also we'll see echoed in Daniel 7 and 8 and so on. So looking at verse 36, chapter 2, Daniel says to the king, "This is the dream." He explained what it was. Now he's going to tell the interpretation before the king. "You, O king Nebuchadnezzar, are a king of kings, for the God of heaven has given you a kingdom, power, strength, and glory." And reminding Nebuchadnezzar that it wasn't through his own merit exactly, but no doubt Nebuchadnezzar, you know, played a part, a role, but really his outstanding majesty, his wealth, his power, his influence, his victories were actually given to him by God. Verse 38, "And wherever the children of men dwell, or the beasts of the field and the birds of the heaven, he, God Almighty, has given them into your hand, and he, God, has made you ruler over them all. You are this head of gold." You remember that this was a statue with a head of gold and a chest of silver and a belly of bronze and two iron legs and then certain rather weak feet and toes. But it says here, King Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, you are the head of gold. But verse 39, "After you, once you've gone, once your kingdom has gone, after you shall arise another kingdom inferior to yours," and that would be the silver kingdom, "then another, a third kingdom of bronze, which also shall rule over all the earth. And the fourth kingdom shall be strong as iron, inasmuch as iron breaks in pieces and shatters all things. And like iron that crushes, that kingdom will break in pieces and crush all the others." So the statue had a head of gold, Babylon, and that was, I guess, the empire there ran from about 609-ish BC all the way down to 539 BC, about 70 or so years. And then came the silver empire of the Medo-Persians, and we covered this in a bit of detail. That ran for another couple of hundred years. It was not as valuable as the Babylonian Empire, not as much quality there, but potentially stronger in some ways. Then came the third world ruling empire of bronze, which was Greece, and we'll cover Greece again a bit later. And then we came to the Roman Empire, the fourth empire of iron, and it had two legs, as you'll recollect, the statue's two legs, and that we've always taken to be symbolic of the Roman Empire at a certain point splitting into the Western Empire ruled from Rome and the city of Rome, and the eastern part of the Roman Empire, which is ruled from Constantinople or Istanbul. That's not exactly dogmatic, but that's what it looks like. And of course, at the end of the two legs, you've got the feet and, of course, 10 toes, all part of the fourth kingdom. Verse 41, "Whereas you saw the feet and toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, the kingdom at its end, let's say, shall be divided. Yet the strength of the iron shall be in it, just as you saw the iron mixed with ceramic clay." So the Roman Empire extends all the way down to a certain dramatic end time event, but at the very end of the Roman Empire, rather than being solid iron, which is of course pretty strong, the 10 toes are a mixture of, you know, miry clay or ceramic clay and an iron, and it's not quite as strong. Verse 42, as the toes, as the 10 toes of the feet were partly of iron and partly of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly fragile. And these 10 toes, we know, represent 10 kings, or 10 little kingdoms. Some must be strong, some must be weak. They combine together, but the whole is fragile. It has got some cracks in there. As you saw, iron mixed with ceramic clay, they will mingle with the seed of men, but they will not adhere to one another, just as iron doesn't mix with clay. So it will be a semblance of unity, but not terribly strong. And I guess that's how you might describe Europe today. Countries like France and Italy and Germany and Spain, currently United Kingdom, they have a union of sorts, but they're pretty selfish. The French don't trust the Germans don't trust the Italians don't trust the Spanish don't trust the French, or nobody trusts the English, and really you've got a union which is fragile, and that's pretty much what we're seeing described here. But notice verse 44, this is the culmination of 4 empires, only 4. They stretch from Babylon all the way down through time, the silver and the bronze and the iron goes all the way down, down, down to the 10 toes, and then something happens when the 10 toes are in existence. It says, verse 44, in the days of these kings, this is the 10 toes, so we believe there'll be 10 kingdoms with this rather weak unity, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed. And the kingdom shall not be left to other people. It shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. So we have 4 world-ruling empires, all the way down to the 5th world-ruling empire, which is the kingdom of God. And just as these other empires were real empires, they weren't imaginations in men's hearts, so God's kingdom is not something in men's hearts, is not some fuzzy-wuzzy, pleasant platitude. It's a real kingdom. It will have a real king, a real territory, real laws, and real citizens. It's every bit as real as Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, Rome, God's kingdom. Verse 45, inasmuch as you saw that the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and that it broke in pieces the iron, bronze, clay, silver, and the gold, the great God has made known to the king what will come to pass after this. The dream is certain, its interpretation is absolutely sure. And so Nebuchadnezzar was given an insight into the next, 2,500 years, really quite, quite a gift to him. But you and I can learn a lot from that. 4 world-ruling empires, and today you and I are living in the time of the feet and the toes. Or I guess we're actually waiting for the final 10 toes to form, shape, and come together. But when that does happen, it says, in the days of those kings, verse 44, right? When those 10 toes are there, visibly, it says, in those days, when those 10 kings or 10 kingdoms are visible, God will set up his kingdom. And the stone, of course, is the stone that the builders rejected. That's Jesus Christ himself. He will come back and establish God's kingdom. So that's a pretty important chapter 2. As I say, many of the comments there about the 4 kingdoms reappear in later chapters. Moving on then to chapter 3, as part of our recap. Chapter 3 was the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Shake the bed, make the bed, into bed you go. And this was the guys, of course, who refused to worship the king's so great image, and as such were invited to recant worship or be tossed into a burning fiery furnace. And of course they said, sorry, we're not under any circumstances prepared to bow down to any of your gods. We trust our God to deliver us. And of course, amazingly, they were delivered. And although they were tossed into the flames and it was so hot that the flames leapt out and burned up lots of the soldiers, these 3 guys walked about quite happily with a 4th person who turned up in the burning fiery furnace. This 4th person, of course, had a form, it says, like unto the Son of God. Interesting. Then chapter 4, we came to one of the surprising, I guess, that we have a chapter here written by a man who was not actually, you know, properly a man of God, because chapter 4 is actually written by King Nebuchadnezzar. So I certainly think in the future we'll get the chance to meet King Nebuchadnezzar when he's resurrected in the great white throne judgment period. And the man obviously had some outstanding qualities, because God's actually incorporated in the Holy Scriptures Nebuchadnezzar's letter, which was chapter 4. And Nebuchadnezzar explains really that he was quite arrogant, and despite many warnings from God, he refused to give God the honor and the glory and the thanks, and as such he was punished. He was warned, and Daniel warned him, but he was just too stubborn, too stiff-necked, and he was sent into the wilderness for 7 years, living like an animal. His hair grew all long and matted, his nails grew like eagle's talons, and he was out scrubbing around in the bushes, having lost his mind for 7 years, until eventually, he learned his lesson, and then God restored him. And we said that was interesting, but potentially also a type, if you look at duality, of maybe the Empire of Babylon being punished for 7 times, just as its king was punished for 7 times. And if you're looking at prophecy, 7 times, we believe, is 7 times 360, because there are 360 days in a prophetic year. This is our understanding. So 7 times passed over King Nebuchadnezzar. If 7 times passes over the Babylonian Empire, that will be 2,520 years. And since it fell in 539 BC, that would mean that it can start to be restored, the Babylonian Empire or its system, round about 1981-82. And I did hear a tape from Mr. Herman Hay once expressing that view. And then in chapter 5, we looked at the Belshazzar, the king. He's a great debauchery, his feast, where he brought all the utensils, the gold and so on, out of the temple of God, and then he used them in this orgy, one imagines, reading between the lines, until he saw the writing on the wall. And you remember, he's busy, you know, boozing, having a great time, joking and laughing, and suddenly chapter 5 verse 5, it says, in the same hour the fingers of a man's hand appeared right out of the blue, out of nothing, and wrote opposite the lampstand on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace. And the king saw the part of the hand that wrote. So, you know, I guess it was an angel, and he allowed his hand to become visible right by the lampstand, where there was plenty of light. And of course, he wrote these words, many, many, tekel, uparsin, which nobody could understand, until, of course, you know, Daniel was invited to come along and, you know, picking up the story and verse 25, this is inscription that was written, many, many, tekel, upharsin. This is interpretation of each word. Many, God has numbered your kingdom, Belshazzar, who was Babylonian, and finished it. My margin says, a mina is 50 shekels. Hold that in your mind for a moment. Tekel, you've been weighed in the balances and found wanting. My margin says, tekel, by the way, is a shekel. And Perez, your kingdom has been divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. And verse 30, that very night Belshazzar, king of the Chaldeans, was slain, and Darius the Mede of the Medo-Persian Empire received the kingdom, being about 62 years old. So that was the downfall and the end of the Babylonian Empire. Babylon was an amazingly fortified city. You probably thought it was impregnable. It had massive walls in height, in width, great gates. But of course, you can outsmart people sometimes. And the guy who was head of the Medo-Persian Empire, Cyrus, he noticed that, well, hang on a second, you've got this huge river Euphrates, which flows into Babylon under the walls at one point. It flows through the city for many, many miles, and then comes out at the far end of Babylon under the walls there. Now, if we could divert the Euphrates, then the river level would fall. If we had armies stationed at the front and at the back they could sneak in and enter through the tunnel. And that's what he did. He had the Euphrates, a big sort of canal dug. He had the Euphrates diverted. Of course, the water then went through the diversion and it stopped flowing pretty much into the city of Babylon. The water level dropped right down, and the Medo-Persians sent their armies in through the much lower level of water, and they captured the city that very night. And it says there that, you know, many tekel uparsin. We said before that if you convert menes, tekels, and peres into coinage, you end up with 2,520 units, known as a gerahs, G-E-R-A-H-S. It's like 50 shekels, 50 shekels, 1 shekel, 25 shekels, been through that before, add it all up. And it's curious, but I'm not saying it's, you know, hugely relevant, but it's curious that the coinage there comes to 2,520, just the same as the 7 times that passed over Nebuchadnezzar. So that's why some people say, well, hang on, you know, that's 2,520 here. It's somewhat coded, you know, many tekel and peres. You have to sort of work the code backwards, turn to shekels, which is 126 shekels, and then multiply by 20 gerahs to a shekel. It's interesting that you get 2,520 in 2 chapters. Is that significant? Does that really mean that from 1981-82 that we expect to see potentially Babylon resurgent? Okay, interesting. Then we're on to chapter 6, which of course was Daniel in the lion's den, and Daniel came through that with flying colors, and that was a pretty interesting story. Then we came to Daniel chapter 7, and when we last spoke, it was Daniel 7 and Daniel 8 that we got to, so I know we hurried through it a little bit, and that's difficult not to do because there's a bunch of information, and I don't want to take, you know, all year just on Daniel, particularly since the more you get into it, the more awkward and at times challenging it can get. But let's go through Daniel 7 as quickly as we can, just as a recap and a reminder that Daniel this time has a vision, right? Previously it was like Nebuchadnezzar. This is Daniel's own vision given to him, and he says, verse 3, chapter 7, 4 great beasts came up from the sea, each different from the other. Now remember, there were 4 metals on the statue, the gold, the silver, the bronze, and down to the iron. And now there are 4 beasts. So it looks like, and I think this is our understanding, that these 4 beasts, if you like, coincide with the 4 metals. The first metal was the head of gold, which was Babylon. And notice verse 4, the first beast was like a lion and had eagle's wings. And we said before that we believe this is Babylon. The lion is the king of beasts, and the eagle, I guess you'd class as the king of birds. And the first beast was like a lion, and we believe that's Babylon, represented by King Nebuchadnezzar. And then verse 5, suddenly another beast, a second beast like a bear, it was raised up on one side, and we believe this beast is like the chest of silver. This is Medo-Persia. So after Babylon came the next empire of Medo-Persia. Medo-Persia was 2 empires collaborating, the Medes and the Persians. And it says here that this bear was raised up on one side, meaning one side was higher than the other. Well, you know, the Persians, I guess, were probably more powerful than the Medes. Then chapter or verse 6, after this, there was another, the third beast, which was like a leopard, which had on its back 4 wings of a bird, and the beast also had 4 heads, and dominion was given to it. So, 1 beast, 2 beasts, 3rd beast, gold, silver, and bronze. The bronze, we said, was Greece, and indeed, it appears to be Greece as pictured here by the leopard. Leopard, a very fast-moving, very cunning, very fierce beast, but also very fast. And as we'll see later, looking at Greece in further prophecies in the next chapter, Alexander the Great, who was the first, you know, great king of Greece, was a man who was amazingly fast. blitzkrieg style warfare in his day. And so, and to make the point, I guess, while we're here, after Alexander died rather suddenly and prematurely, his empire was split into four. And it says here this beast had four heads, and Greece broke into four on Alexander's death. So that was the first three beasts. The fourth one is unusual, verse 7. After this, I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, exceedingly strong. It had huge iron teeth. I guess we can see the link there to the iron legs of the statue. But it had huge iron teeth. It was devouring, breaking in pieces, trampling. It was different from all the beasts before it, and it had 10 horns. Now, the first beast was like a lion, then like a bear, then like a leopard, but this one, Daniel couldn't find anything that this one was like. It's like, well, it's just a beast. It's dreadful, it's awesome, it's incredible, it's phenomenally strong. It's got huge and great iron teeth, and it just stamps and crushes and breaks things in pieces, and also it's got 10 horns. So it's not like any beast that Daniel could think of, and he's really quite taken aback by this beast. It's like, wow, look at this one. And it's 10 horns, and we'll see later the 10 horns represent 10 kingdoms that are related to this great empire. Verse 8, I was considering the horns and thinking, what are they all about? And there was another horn, a little one, coming up among them, before whom three of the first horns were plucked out by the roots. And there, in this little horn, were eyes like the eyes of a man, and the mouth speaking pompous words. That's like, this is amazing, thinks Daniel. What does all this signify? What does it picture? And he's really, really quite mystified by it. And then if you remember the Daniel 2, we had the four empires, and then of course came the fifth one, which was God's kingdom. And this is what we see here. Verse 9, I watched this particular beast and his horns till thrones were put in place and the Ancient of Days was seated. Dropping down to the end of verse 10, the court was seated and the books were opened, and I watched then because of the sound of the pompous words which the horn was speaking. I watched till the beast was slain and his body destroyed and given to the burning flame. Verse 13, I was watching in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man. So the fourth beast has now been slain, it's been killed, its body's been burned. And now what happens immediately after the fourth beast is disposed of? Verse 13, I was watching the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man coming with the clouds of heaven. He came to the Ancient of Days, that's the Father, and they brought him near before him. Then, now that the fourth beast has been disposed of, then to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom, that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom the one which shall not be destroyed. So, in essence, it's pretty clear, I think, that these four beasts and then the Son of Man being given his kingdom parallel pretty closely the four metals of the great statue in Daniel 2, and the stone that was cut out that crushed the statue and then expanded to become God's kingdom on earth. So it's the same here. This is God's kingdom in verse 14, this everlasting kingdom, and it says that all peoples, nations, and languages will serve the King, Jesus Christ. And so that's pretty close parallel. But Daniel is still perplexed, because, he's still thinking about that fourth beast that was just like, well, wow, incredible. Verse 19, it's verse 17. Those great beasts, which are four kings or kingdoms which arise out of the earth. And this is what the angel is making plain to Daniel. But the saints of the Most High shall receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, even forever and ever. Obviously, after the fourth beast has been taken care of and slain and disposed of. And of course, we picture this on the Day of Trumpets in part, and of course the millennium is talking of those days when you and I, assuming we are there, do possess the kingdom forever and ever. But verse 19, then says Daniel, I wish to know the truth about the fourth beast, because, like, just, I'm curious, which was different from all the others, exceedingly dreadful, with its teeth of iron and, new detail, its nails of bronze, which devoured, broke in pieces and trampled the residue with its feet. I mean, this is just astonishing, he says to the angel, tell me more. I want to know about the 10 horns, verse 20, that were on its head, and about this other horn which came up before which three fell, namely that horn which had eyes and a mouth which spoke pompous words, whose appearance was greater than its fellows. I was watching, and the same horn, this little horn, this arrogant little horn with a big mouth, was making war against the saints and prevailing against them until Jesus Christ returned. So, you know, Daniel's just saying, well, I'm curious about this fourth beast, especially about the 10 horns, and especially about this little arrogant horn, because that little horn, I can see that in my vision, it makes war against the saints of God. And what's more, it appears to be prevailing against them right up until the Ancient of Days came. I want to know about that. And the angel says, verse 23, the fourth beast shall be the fourth or a fourth kingdom on earth, which shall be different from all other kingdoms, and shall devour the whole earth, trample it, and break it in pieces. And as we said, we believe that is the Roman Empire. But of course, if you think about it, the Roman Empire is gone, isn't it? There's no Roman Empire today on planet Earth. The Roman Empire is history. Way, way back, a long time ago, Wikipedia, we quoted this last time, but Wikipedia, if you pop in a detail or two about Roman Empire, I'll quote the following, it's fairly brief. It just says, Romulus Augustus was a Western Roman Emperor who reigned from 475 to 476 AD. So that's like over 1,500 years ago, isn't it? Carrying on. Historically, says Wikipedia, his reign has been used to mark the end of the Roman Empire in the West. It carries on. Romulus Augustus, his deposition, when he stepped down, is traditionally cited as the official end of the Roman Empire and the beginning of the Middle Ages. So, if you look into the encyclopedias in history, they'll tell you that the Roman Empire finished a long time ago. The official termination of the Roman Empire was 476 AD. That's what history says. And yet, surely, did we not read that all of these empires and so on go on the way right down to Christ's return? Doesn't this little horn that pops up among the ten, doesn't it make war on the saints until Ancient of Days comes? So, hang on. If the fourth beast is finished in 476 AD, then where does that leave us? Of course, that leaves us with the ten horns. Because, verse 24, the ten horns are ten kings which shall arise from or out of this kingdom. So these ten horns come from the kingdom, out of it. And Mr. Armstrong says, and I'll just quote him from his book on Who is the Beast. He says, I'll cut this a bit short. The ten horns then are ten kingdoms to arise out of the fourth kingdom, the Roman Empire. These kings, also called kingdoms, continue from AD 476 until the time when the stone, Christ and his kingdom, smashes the image on its toes and the kingdom is given to the saints. So Mr. Armstrong says that these ten kings are ten kingdoms, or these ten horns, sorry, are ten kings of kingdoms which will arise from the Roman Empire after AD 476. He continues, Mr. Armstrong, therefore, since in actual history there have never been ten contemporaneous kingdoms that have continued out of the Roman Empire side by side down to the present, and that's for sure, you can't find ten kingdoms that have existed side by side for centuries since then down to today, hasn't happened. And he continues, carrying on, Mr. Armstrong, since there have been nine successive kingdoms ruling that territory, from 476 to the present, therefore, we know that the kingdoms represented by the horns are successive, that's one after the other, not contemporaneous. And so, verse 24, the ten horns are ten kings who shall arise from or out of this particular fourth kingdom, and another shall arise after them. He shall be different from the first ones, and shall subdue three kings. This is talking, we believe, of the papacy, and the Pope, the Vatican. Verse 25, and if you think of the Vatican in the next two, three verses, he shall speak pompous words against the Most High. Think the Vatican might do that? Think a man who calls himself the Holy Father, who has his adherents numbering close on a billion on the earth, call him the Holy Father? You know, in place of Christ, the Vicar of Christ? Think that might be pompous words against the Most High God? He shall persecute the saints of the Most High. Think the Roman Catholic Church has ever had played any part in an Inquisition, and shall intend to change times and law. The Catholic Church pretty much says that it can prove its authority because the present world accepts that it has moved the sanctity of the Sabbath to Sunday. The Catholic Church will pretty much admit that you can't find any or much evidence in Scripture that Sunday is a day to worship. They say, we did that. We did that. We moved the holiness, the sanctity of God's day from the Sabbath to our day, Sunday. We did that. And all you nations out there, all you peoples out there, all you Protestants out there, you know, by accepting Sunday, you're accepting our power, our authority, our influence. Carrying on. Then the saints shall be given into his hand for a time and times and a half a time. And I guess if you're understanding this, scripture is looking towards the very end, when the stone smashes the statue, when the beast is slain and Jesus takes authority again. At the end time, it says, right at the end time, the saints, God's people, shall be given into his hand, into the Vatican's hand, for a time and times and half a time. And probably that means for 3.5 years, you know, the Pope, Catholic Church, will, you know, be mayhem on God's people. Verse 26, but the court shall be seated, thankfully, and it shall take away his dominion to consume and destroy it forever. Then, at that time, when God's people are delivered, those who've been under the kosh from this little horn, then the kingdom and dominions and the greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven, not up in heaven, shall be given to the people, the saints of the Most High. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions shall serve and obey him. So that's pretty much, I think, where we got to last week. We sent out a chart, which hopefully most of you would have got just before the last time we spoke on this, on our Bible study. Sent a chart out that was taken from one of the old Ambassador College correspondence courses, and Mr. Armstrong had it in his Who is the Beast? And that does sort of show you side by side in a sort of a column format, the heads and the horns and the elbows and the toes and the knees and things, to make it a bit easier to try and follow. But this is a Bible study. You can't just read this and grasp it. You've got to put a wee bit of work in to try and just put, you know, two and two together. In terms of the 10 horns, those are 10 kingdoms which arose out of the now finished Roman Empire. It finished in 476 officially. Since that time, there have been, Mr. Armstrong says, 9 resurrections. The booklet or the chart will tell you which ones those are, right down to the last one being the sort of the Hitler Mussolini resurrection. And of course, there's one to go. So the 10th horn has yet to arrive. And I guess that's the one we're all still waiting for. Then chapter 8. Chapter 8 is another vision that appears to Daniel, and he sees basically a ram. In verse 3, I lifted my eyes and saw there beside the river was a ram which had two horns. And if we look across to verse 20, it tells us the ram with the two horns is Media and Persia. So that's straightforward. Verse 5, while he's watching the ram, he sees a male goat, a he-goat. Verse 5, which came from the west across the surface of the whole earth without touching the ground as a high-speed supersonic male goat. And the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. And verse 21 tells us, the male goat is the kingdom of Greece. And the large horn, the notable horn, is its first king. And that, of course, would be our friend Alexander the Great. Verse 22, as for the broken horn and the foe that stood up in its place, four kingdoms shall arise out of that nation, but not with its power. And just recapping on what we said before, Medo-Persia was a powerful empire. It replaced Babylon. It was the chest of silver. It was the bear. But along came the third empire, namely the bronze of the statue and the leopard with the four wings and the four heads. And that leopard was our friend Alexander, who was quite an astounding individual himself. Alexander the Great conquered the known world like in half an hour, almost. He went at blistering speed. It says in verse 5 that he raced across the whole earth, not even touching the ground. He just blew across the earth amazingly. It took him 2 years, virtually, from when he left his home country before he conquered the entirety of Asia Minor. 2 years. He got as far as India, and the man was, you know, incredible. He had totally defeated the Persians, they reckon, around about 331 BC. That was a decisive battle that ended the Persian Empire. And yet Alexander, at the peak of his power, his might, died prematurely at the age of 33. And that was, you know, I guess quite a surprise. So he was at the peak, looked great, looked strong. He conquered everything, and stories say that he was actually quite despondent, thinking, what else can I do? You know, I'm only 33. I've been in the governing for 2-3 years now. I've conquered the entire world. You know, my army stretched across the known world. Where do I go now? Who else do I defeat and conquer? But anyway, he died, and his, I think he had two sons and a brother. They were all murdered in the next 12, 13, 14 months. So there's nobody to take his place. And so Greece was divided into, the Greek Empire was divided into four parts. His four main generals took, you know, a piece each. There's a guy called Cassander. He became, I guess, leader of the Greek part of Greece. There was a guy called Lysimachus, who was over Asia Minor. Ptolemy, with a P in the front, Ptolemy, was over Egypt. And one called Seleucus, who was over the Babylon area. So the empire of Greece didn't last too long, but it split into four. Now, dropping down to verse 8, the male goat grew very great, but when he became strong, the large horn was broken, and in place of it, four notable ones came up toward the four winds of heaven, north, south, east, and west. And that's these four generals of Alexander. And out of one of them came a little horn. And this is not like the little horn of the previous chapter. That was the papacy in the Vatican. This is not a religious little horn. This is a guy from the sort of the military end of things. Out of one of them, and it turned out to be Seleucus, came a little horn which grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the glorious land. And it grew up to the host of heaven. It cast down some of the host and some of the stars to the ground and trampled them. He even exalted himself, because this is a king of some sort, a little horn, but a king is represented by a horn. He even exalted himself as high as the prince of the host, talking of Jesus, and by him the daily sacrifices were taken away, and the place of his sanctuary, God's temple, was cast down. Because of transgression, an army was given over to the horn to oppose the daily sacrifices, and he, this individual, cast truth down to the ground. He did all this and prospered. So here's a very notable individual, a king, who, it says, verse 7, exalted himself as high as Jesus Christ, and took away the daily sacrifices from the temple and cast down the truth. He's quite an amazing individual. Now, there is a type of this historically, but notice verse 17. The angel came near where I stood, and when he came I was afraid and fell on my feet or face, but he said to me, understand, son of man, the vision refers to the time of the end. So it's important that we realize that this little horn, which exalts itself up to as high as Jesus Christ, which casts down the sanctuary, tramples on the host and the stars and so on, prospers. This particular little horn pictures something that didn't take place a long time ago, other than in type. It applies to the time of the end. It says, understand, Daniel. The vision refers to the time of the end. And that's obviously yet to happen. Verse 19, he said, look, I'm making known to you, Daniel, what shall happen in the latter time of the indignation. For the appointed time it shall be. And notice verse 26, and the vision of the evening as mornings, which was told is true. Seal up the vision, for it refers to many days in the future. So what we're looking at here is an explanation or a prophecy that will have relevance to you and me in the future. This little horn, which is so arrogant, and we saw last time we commented that if you look historically, you can find a man who fits the bill here, a guy called Antiochus Epiphanes. He came to Jerusalem way back about 167 BC, obviously long, long after the days when Daniel was prophesying, because Daniel was writing about 540-odd BC. So this was like, 400 years or so later. Antiochus Epiphanes, he believed he was God in the flesh. He actually had coins minted in his honor. He even stamped Theos Epiphanes, God manifest. Have you seen me? You've seen God. That was this guy's viewpoint. So he was pretty arrogant. I'm God in the flesh. That's what I am. He came to Jerusalem and he caused massive destruction there. One of the things he did was he stopped the daily sacrifice for a period of about 3 years or so. He actually erected a statue of a pagan god, Zeus Olympius, in the temple. So he stopped the priests from carrying out the sacrifices, which they're supposed to do. He erected a statue in the temple area, in the Holy of Holies, behind the special curtain, and he even sacrificed pigs, because he knew they were unclean and offensive and an abomination. So he had pigs slaughtered on the altar of burnt offering. And he killed many, many Jews. So it was a pretty awful time. This guy pictures somebody yet to come, somebody who will have a similar approach, because the vision is about the future. It's about the end time. As we said before, he was eventually thrown out by a guy called Judas Maccabeus, who recaptured Jerusalem and purified the temple and destroyed these idols and restored the sacrifices, and the Jews still commemorate that liberation every year with their feast of Hanukkah, because that's the cleansing of the temple, restoring the sacrifices and so on. And so it still is commemorated. Notice verse 13. Then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to that certain one who was speaking, how long will the vision be concerning the daily sacrifices and the transgression of desolation, the giving of both the sanctuary and the host to be trampled underfoot? And he said to me, for 2,300 days, and then the sanctuary shall be cleansed. And it says 2,300 days in my Bible, but my margin says evening mornings. 2,300 evening mornings. Not days, but evening mornings. And that appears to relate to the fact that on an average day, there'd be two sacrifices offered. One in the morning, one in the evening. If you turn to Exodus chapter 29... Exodus chapter 29 and verse 38. It's telling the instructions here to the priests and so on what they should be doing in terms of daily sacrifices. It says, verse 38, now this is what you shall offer on the altar: two lambs of the first year, meaning two young lambs, day by day continually. So some people refer to this as the continual. I think Mr. Fleury prefers that term, the continual. So you'd have two lambs, two young lambs, less than a year old, day by day, continually. One lamb you shall offer in the morning, verse 39, and the other lamb you shall offer at twilight, in the evening. Dropping on to verse 42, this shall be a continual burnt offering throughout your generations at the door of the tabernacle of meeting before the eternal, where I will meet you to speak with you. So every day, this was the continual two sacrifices, one in the morning, one in the evening. I believe it's Mr. Flurry refers to that as the continual. Mr. Mortensen, I think, gave a message some 6, 7, 8 years ago entitled The Two-a-Days, because these are the two sacrifices per day, the two-a-days, one in the morning, one in the evening. So back to Daniel. It talks about, verse 14, that this particular devastation being caused by this little horn shall last, it says here, 2,300 days or 2,300 evenings, mornings, as the Hebrew says. Well, if that's the case, and it's 2,300 evenings, mornings, that's 1,150 days, because you have to divide by two. There's a two-a-day, 2 days, the continual is two-a-day. If there's 2 a day and there's 2,300, then that's a total of 1,150 days. And I think the Good News Bible actually translates that verse, the vision will continue for 1,150 days, during which evening and morning sacrifices will not be offered. And if you look back to the days of Antiochus Epiphanes, I think it's not, you can't actually prove to the day, but it's pretty close to that, and of course historical records aren't fantastic anyway, but it looks like they were indeed stopped for about that period of time. Now the Seventh-day Adventists build an entire doctrine around this 2,300 days, because they claim it is a day. They say, well, no, it's 2,300 days, that's what it says in our King James Version Bible, and since in prophecy a day equals a year, this is which is actually, you know, that's part's true, and this is 2,300 years. And they say that up in heaven, God's sanctuary was cast down for 2,300 years. And they run that from 457 BC, which is a date we'll come across ourselves later, right through to 1844. At which point the heavenly sanctuary gets cleansed and so on and so forth. Well, you know, we won't belabor that, but they're wrong. Okay. Verse 23, because now we're getting to the latter end fulfillment. Verse 23, in the latter time of their kingdom, and that's probably round about now, in the next 2, 3, 4, 5, 10 years, whatever we've got left, in the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors have reached their fullness, a king shall arise, having fierce features, or a fierce countenance, who understands sinister schemes. Or one translation says, who is skilled in intrigue. So this is somebody you and I can look out for. And because this is yet to happen, Daniel's prophecies, he didn't understand himself. He was told to seal them up till the time of the end. Well, that time is now about here. And it just says, look, this little horn that exalts himself as high as the prince of the host and takes away the daily sacrifices and tramples down the host and so on. Okay, that happened, if you like, as a illustration, as a prototype with this guy Antiochus, but that's not what the prophecy was about. That's just an example. The actual prophecy is about the days yet ahead of us. So somewhere in the future, you and I can look out for a king, or might be a president perhaps, who knows what title they'll use, but he'll have fierce features, a fierce countenance, and he will understand sinister schemes or be skilled in intrigue. He'll be pretty crafty, this guy, whoever he is. His power, verse 24, shall be mighty, but not by his own power. He'll be aided and abetted by potentially either other human kingdoms or by Satan himself. He shall destroy fearfully, or the margin says extraordinarily. He'll be destructive. He shall prosper and thrive. He shall destroy the mighty and also the holy people. This guy is going to be quite somebody. Fierce looking, skilled in intrigue and dealings behind the scenes. He will be added to by great power from elsewhere, either other support from other nations or directly from Satan himself. And it says he will destroy in an extraordinary manner. He'll destroy the mighty and also the holy people. And Mr. Hay used to say that meant Israel's armies, so America, Britain, and also the holy people, the church. This guy is totally destructive. Verse 25, through his cunning, through shrewdness. He shall cause deceit to prosper under his hand. He shall magnify himself in his heart. I'm so great. You know, I'm the best there is. I'm the Almighty. I'm God on earth. He shall destroy many in their prosperity, or I think the New American Standard says he'll destroy many while they're at ease. I guess he's so cunning, so devious, they don't see him coming. He's there, but they don't recognize what he's going to do, because he's just so deceitful. He shall even rise against the prince of princes, that's Jesus Christ. But he shall be broken without human hand. And so this is a man who is yet to appear. I guess this is what people refer to as the Antichrist, or what they mean by the Antichrist. This man is something special. He's a highly destructive of the mighty. Potentially that means the armies of America and Britain and the holy people, God's people. This guy is really, you know, an amazing individual. If you look at Isaiah chapter 10, I think we were here last time. Isaiah chapter 10, it gives us a clue as to which nationality he might be, and it's only a clue, so I'm not saying this is absolutely certain. But Isaiah 10 does refer to the nation of Assyria, which of course is we believe Germany. Looking at Isaiah chapter 10 and verse 13, we'll come back in a moment to see who the he is, but this individual says, by the strength of my hand I have done it, by my wisdom, for I am prudent, and I'm sharp. Also, I have removed the boundaries of the people. I have robbed their treasuries. You know, this guy is a conqueror. I have put down inhabitants like a valiant man. My hand has found like a nest the riches of the people. And as one gathers eggs that are left, I have gathered all the earth. And there was no one who moved his wing, nor opened his mouth with even a peep. So here's a guy who says that he is the all-conquering hero. He's robbed the treasuries of the world. He's gathered riches wherever he sought around the whole world. He's done it. His wisdom, his strength, his arrogance. And who is he? Well, verse 5. Woe to Assyria. Let's call it Germany. Woe to Germany. The rod of my anger and the staff in whose hand is my indignation. I, says God, will send him, Germany, against an ungodly nation. That's unfortunately our people. And against the people of my wrath, I will give him a charge. This is God gives Germany, you know, a commission. A mission. I'll give him charge to seize the spoil, to take the prey, and to tread them down like the mire of the streets. Pretty horrific prospect. Yet, verse 7, the German nation and the German leader does not mean so, nor does his heart think so, but it is in his heart to destroy and cut off not a few nations. For he says, are not my princes altogether kings? So, you know, God gives a particular commission, but the guy gets carried away. Verse 12, therefore, it shall come to pass, when the Eternal has performed all his work on Mount Zion and in Jerusalem, that's punishing them, that he will say, I will now punish the fruit of the arrogant heart of the king of Assyria and the glory of his haughty looks. So it does seem that it's most likely to be the German nation which will dominate the end time, and it does look like it's going to be a German individual, the king of Assyria, who's going to be the arrogant, pompous individual with the fierce countenance, the fierce features, who's going to be devious, skilled in intrigue, and is going to work himself into a position of great power and destroy, including God's people. So you and I guess, be well worthwhile looking out for this guy and not being caught by surprise when he appears on the scene. So that's us up to, I guess, pretty much where we got to last time. So I guess that's a bit of a long recap, but at least we're up to speed. Now chapter 9, we can perhaps read the first part of chapter 9 is a prayer of Daniel to God, so there's not a huge amount to comment on there, so perhaps we can make a bit of progress. Chapter 9, well, verse 27 of the previous chapter, I, Daniel, fainted and was sick for days. And this is an astonishing vision that Daniel just saw. He was just like, this little horn, it's so arrogant. It exalts us up to the prince in heaven, the almighty God, and it destroys God's people and the mighty. It's like, wow. So he was taken aback, and you and I should be, you know, very much alert to it. But chapter 9, verse 1, In the first year of Darius, the son of Ahasuerus, of the lineage of the Medes, he was made king over the realm of the Chaldeans. In the first year of his reign, I, Daniel, understood by the books, that would be the scriptures, the number of years specified by the word of the Eternal, given through Jeremiah the prophet, that he would accomplish 70 years in the desolations of Jerusalem. So Daniel, reading the writings of Jeremiah, I guess already recognized as a scripture, and he notices that there's 70 years during which Babylon is going to desolate the kingdoms around there, and that Jerusalem will suffer during that time. 70 years. Interesting. And I guess we may as well look at that before we move on. So if we turn to Jeremiah 25, you can see what Daniel was looking at, and this prompted Daniel to start praying to God and saying, well, I think, as I count it, God, I think the time is up. Jeremiah 25, and let's start in verse 8. Jeremiah 25 and verse 8. Therefore thus says the Eternal of hosts, this is red letters, therefore, because you have not heard my words, talking to Judah, behold, I will send and take all the families of the north, says Eternal, and Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, my servant. So, there's something special with Nebuchadnezzar, because God used him. He said, I'm going to call Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, my servant, and bring them against this land, against its inhabitants, against these nations, plural, all around, and will utterly destroy them, and make them an astonishment, a hissing, and perpetual desolations. So God's going to punish not just Jerusalem and Judah, but all the nations in the area. And he's going to use Nebuchadnezzar, verse 11. And this whole land shall be a desolation and an astonishment, and these nations, plural, shall serve the king of Babylon 70 years. And so Daniel's thinking, 70 years? I think that time's up. Then it will come to pass, when 70 years are completed, that I will then punish the king of Babylon and that nation, the land of the Chaldeans, for their iniquity, says Eternal, and will make it a perpetual desolation. So I will bring on that land all my words, which I have pronounced against it, all that is written in this book, which Jeremiah has prophesied concerning all the nations, plural. So, from that it's quite obvious to Daniel that, 70 years, things should be happening now. We turn to Jeremiah 29 and read verses 10 through 14, because after the 70 years is over, Daniel reads that other things are bound to happen, and it's good news as far as he's concerned. Jeremiah 29 and verse 10. For thus says the Eternal, so it's a thus saith the Lord, there's no arguing. For thus says the Eternal, after 70 years are completed in Babylon, when it was to rule and reign and dominate, I will visit you, Judah and Jerusalem, and perform my good word toward you, and cause you to return to this place. Now if you're Daniel, a great patriot, and a great lover of your own people, and a lover of Jerusalem and where God's temple was, this is like, oh wow. After 70 years are completed, God will cause us to return to Jerusalem. Wow. Verse 11, for I know the thoughts that I think toward you, says Eternal, thoughts of peace and not of evil, to give you a future and a hope. Then you will call upon me and go and pray to me, and I will listen to you. And you will seek me and find me when you search for me with all your heart. I will be found by you, says Eternal, and will bring you back from your captivity. I will gather you from all the nations and from all the places where I have driven you, says Eternal, and I will bring you to the place from which I caused you to be carried away captive. So Daniel read that and he just thought, okay, well, Babylon came to power around about 609 BC. He didn't call it that, of course, but we know that's roughly when it took place. And he's thinking, well, 70 years have passed. The time is up. The time that Jeremiah wrote about is up, and that should mean that our people can start to go back from their captivity back to Jerusalem. Wow. And so he's very excited by this, and so verse 3, he starts to pray to God. Then I set my face toward the Lord God to make request by prayer and supplications with fasting sackcloth, and ashes. And I prayed to the Eternal my God and made confession and said, O Lord, great and awesome God, who keeps his covenant and mercy with those who love him and with those who keep his commandments, excuse me, we have sinned and committed iniquity. We have done wickedly and rebelled, even by departing from your precepts and your judgments. So, you know, Daniel knows there's nothing to hide here. The history of Israel, and particularly Judah, was pretty well known. Verse 6, neither have we heeded your servants, the prophets, who spoke in your name to our kings and our princes, to our fathers, and all the people of the land. You know, you sent Isaiah, you sent other prophets over the years. We ignored them. Verse 7, O Lord, righteousness belongs to you, but to us, shame of face as it is this day, to the men of Judah, to the inhabitants of Jerusalem and all Israel, those near and those far off in all the countries to which you have driven them, because of the unfaithfulness which they have committed against you. O Lord, to us belongs shame of face, to our kings, our princes, our fathers, because we have sinned against you. To the Lord our God belong mercy and forgiveness, though we have rebelled against him. We have not obeyed the voice of the Lord our God to walk in his laws, which he set before us by his servants the prophets. Yes, says Daniel, all Israel has transgressed your law and has departed so as not to obey your voice. Therefore, the curse and the oath written in the law of Moses, the servant of God, have been poured out on us because we have sinned against him. And if you go back and read Leviticus 26, Deuteronomy 28, the blessings and cursings, you'll see that God said, look, if you follow me and obey me and keep my statutes and commandments, I'll bless you in the city, in the country, in the storeroom, in your health. But if you go contrary to my ways, if you do not obey them, you'll be cursed and you'll be put to flight and the alien shall rise up above you and so on. And Daniel says it happened, just like you said. Verse 12, and he has confirmed his words, which he spoke against us and against our judges who judged us, by bringing upon us a great disaster. For under the whole heaven, such never has been done as what has been done to Jerusalem. And of course, Jerusalem was an outstanding city in his day. Solomon's palace would have been one of the wonders of the world, I would have thought. And some of the temple of God, quite outstanding, quite astonishing, a multi-billion dollar structure, gone. Just rubble and stones and wild animals. Verse 13, as it is written in the law of Moses, all this disaster has come upon us. Yet we have not made our prayer before the Eternal our God, that we might turn from our iniquities and understand your truth, even then. Therefore, the Eternal has kept the disaster in mind and brought it upon us. For the Eternal our God is righteous in all the works which he does, though we have not obeyed his voice. And now, O Lord our God, who brought your people out of the land of Egypt with a mighty hand and made yourself a name as it is this day, we have sinned. We have done wickedly. O Eternal, or O Lord, according to all your righteousness, I pray, let your anger and your fury be turned away from your city Jerusalem, your holy mountain. Because for our sins and for the iniquities of our fathers, Jerusalem and your people have become a reproach to all who are around us. Now therefore, our God, hear the prayer of your servant and his supplications, and for the Lord's sake cause your face to shine on your sanctuary, which is desolate. Oh my God, he's getting quite personal, and obviously he's very emotional, and he's got a strong desire here. Oh my God, verse 18, incline your ear and hear. Now open your eyes and see our desolations and the city which is called by your name. For we do not present our supplications before you because of our righteous deeds, but because of your great mercies. And I guess that's well worth bearing that comment in mind, because, you know, Daniel has a particular, very serious issue here. He's talking about the future of the very nation of Judah and the city of Jerusalem. But notice, you know, he's saying, we don't deserve this. We're not coming because of our righteous deeds. We're just coming because you are who you are. We're coming to you because of your mercy. verse 18 again, and just saying, you know, when you and I go to God in prayer, we can't ever go to God and say, look, I deserve this, and I've always tithed, therefore, you know, I go your way, therefore. We don't approach God that way. We don't say, God, you must heal me because I've been always loyal to your church, and, you know, I've never spoken against Mr. Armstrong, therefore you must heal me. No. We go to God on the basis of His Word, His promises, His goodness, His mercy. Say, well, I don't deserve to be prospered here, Father. I don't deserve to be healed of this condition. I don't deserve any of these things. But I'm coming to you because you're who you are, because you made provision, because you made promises, because you went into covenant, and it's because of your mercy, your compassion. Verse 18 again, oh my God, incline your ear and hear, open your eyes and see our desolations and the city which is called by your name. For we do not present our supplications before you because of our righteous deeds, but because of your great mercies. O Lord, hear. O Lord, forgive. O Lord, listen and act. It's okay to speak to God that way, as long as you do it, you know, politely. Do not delay for your own sake, my God, for your city and your people are called by your name. You know, God, this is your reputation's at stake here. This is your city. Everybody knows that. And as long as it's dilapidated and broken down and ruined, what does that say about your name, God? Please intervene now. While I was speaking, praying, and confessing my sin and the sin of my people Israel, and presenting my supplication before the Eternal my God for the holy mountain of my God, yes, while I was speaking in prayer, the man Gabriel, whom I had seen in the vision at the beginning, being caused to fly swiftly, reached me about the time of the evening offering. So, you know, Daniel's busy praying, and while he's praying, along comes Gabriel at high speed. Verse 22, and he informed me and talked with me and said, O Daniel, I have now come forth to give you skill to understand. And I guess we better leave the next part because it's quite an interesting and a highly controversial part. Gabriel's comments have caused volumes to be written. There's much dispute, even among the people of God, the Church of God. There's a great amount of variety of opinions as to what Gabriel then announced to Daniel. But we'll cover that perhaps more slowly next week and go through some of the opinions and varieties, and you can, as I say, you pay your money, you take your chance. But okay, that's a pretty good place to finish for today. So at least we've caught up to speed with the way we were, making some progress, and we should be finished by the end of the year. I think on that basis, we'll conclude our Bible study.